Because we lack a clear understanding of what exactly gets broken, other than our metaphorical heart, we are likely to misunderstand, misinterpret, or downright ignore the many aspects of our mental and behavioral functioning that are influenced by our broken hearts. As a result, our recovery from heartbreak can take longer and it can be less complete. Further, we are less likely to be empathetic and compassionate toward our loved ones when it is their heart that gets broken. And of course, it also contributes to the unfortunate societal disenfranchisement of heartbreak. In order to heal as thoroughly and as rapidly as we can, we must first gain a more accurate appreciation of what heartbreak actually does to us. And the best place to start is at the literal top, our brain. A few years ago, Ethan Cross and his colleagues at the University of Michigan put out a call for people who had been through a recent and painful romantic breakup. One by one, these paid volunteers were placed in functional MRI machines, scanners that reveal areas of the brain with increased blood flow, suggesting increased activity, and instructed to stare at a photograph of the person who broke their heart and relive the breakup in their mind. As the scanner gathered images of their brain, one razor-thin slice at a time. Rough as that might sound, the volunteers' ordeal was not over yet. The researchers wanted to be able to compare what happens in our brain when we experience sharp emotional pain to what happens when we experience sharp physical pain. And so back to the functional MRI machine the volunteers went. This time, a neurosensory analyzer, a machine that transfers heat to the skin of the forearm, was used to apply increasing levels of uncomfortable heat to the volunteer's forearm for 7-second intervals. At first, the heat was set to arouse only mild discomfort, but it went up from there, peaking at pain levels subjects rated an 8 on a 10-point scale, where 10 was unbearable. When the scientists compared the two brain scans, what they saw was remarkable. The exact same areas of the brain became activated when subjects relived their heartbreak as when they experienced the highest degree of physical pain, the level that was only a couple of notches below unbearable. To put these findings in context, think back to when you had a really bad headache, stomach ache, or backache. Few of us would consider the discomfort such aches cause as being anywhere near unbearable, yet we typically find them quite debilitating nonetheless. Most of us find it difficult to work efficiently, study productively, or complete certain tasks in such situations, and we often find it necessary to lie down or take over-the-counter medication in order to resume our normal activities. Now imagine trying to do your job, study, or complete your responsibilities if the pain you were experiencing was near unbearable levels. Imagine trying to think clearly or creatively, reason, problem-solve, attend to small details, operate heavy machinery, or even compose a lengthy email. Further, consider that the subjects in these experiments were exposed to near unbearable pain for only a few seconds. A broken heart can cause sharp emotional pain that lasts for hours, days, weeks, even months. The fMRI experiment was only one of dozens of similar studies, all of which demonstrated how heartbreak elicits reactions in our brains and bodies that cause substantial cognitive and functional impairments. In one study, the mere thought of being without a significant other was enough to temporarily lower participants' IQ, their intelligence quotient, and significantly harm their performance on tasks involving logic and reasoning. Now it is easier to understand why Kathy, the cancer survivor who had trouble getting over her 6-month relationship with Rich, failed to register Rich's rationale for breaking up as reasonable and began seeking alternative explanations. It is also clear why Ben struggled to function at work after his dog Bova died. Indeed, this is what makes having a broken heart so devastating. Not only are we in severe emotional anguish, and not only are the effects of our anguish severely debilitating, but too often, both our pain and our functional impairment go unacknowledged and ignored. We would never expect someone to function normally at school or their job if they were experiencing near unbearable physical pain throughout the day. But Ben was given no consideration for his profound emotional suffering or for its debilitating impact on his functioning. Registering severe physical pain is only one of the ways our brain reacts when our heart is broken. There is another, and it is much more insidious. You're gonna have to face it, you're addicted to love. One of the main reasons Kathy rejected Rich's explanation for why he broke up with her was that it came only 2 weeks after their weekend in New England. Kathy became convinced something must have happened that weekend to tilt the relationship off course, even though at the time she thought it had gone very well. She spent months combing through her memories of that weekend, repeatedly examining every photograph and selfie she had taken and every text she had sent and received during and after those 3 days. She was utterly obsessed. The question was, why didn't she just accept Rich's explanation and move on? Surely it would have been less painful to do so than to go through anguish for months at a time. Why was she so compelled to go on this wild goose chase? Reliving old memories and going through pictures is something many of us might do in the first hours, days, or even weeks following a breakup or the loss of a beloved pet. However, our urge to do so usually declines over time, and at some point ceases altogether. Kathy's did not, despite the fact that the exercise must have been extremely painful. After all, she was submerging herself in memories of a happy and romantic weekend for minutes and hours at a time, only to then return to the harsh reality of the breakup. "I feel like a detective searching through a crime scene," Kathy explained in one of our rare sessions during this period. "I know the clues are there, but I just can't put them together." Kathy might have felt like a detective, but her metaphor was totally incorrect. She wasn't behaving like Sherlock Holmes. She was behaving like a drug addict. Studies of the brain have revealed that romantic love involves the activation of both brain structures, such as the ventral tegmental area, the caudate nuclei, and the nucleus accumbens, and neurochemistry that are highly associated with addiction. Indeed, when our heart is broken by romantic love or infatuation, our brain responds very similarly to the brains of addicts going through withdrawal from cocaine or heroin. We become intensely focused on the person who broke our heart, the drug, and feel intense cravings for them that are extremely difficult to banish, ignore, or soothe. The lack of contact with a person, i.e. not getting our fix, makes us unable to focus, disturbs our sleep and appetite, causes anxiety, lethargy, irritability, crying spells, depression, and intense feelings of need, loneliness, that no one but our heartbreaker can ease, just like cocaine and heroin do. Kathy was experiencing powerful symptoms of withdrawal from Rich, but she was not aware of it. Her cravings for him and for the relationship were so strong she was getting her fix the way she could, in her mind. If Kathy couldn't have the real heroin of being with Rich, she could at least get the methadone of the memories of the time she shared with him. Since Kathy was unaware of how her brain was driving her behavior, she made sense of her intense ruminating the only way she could, by convincing herself there was a mystery to be solved. But the real reason she kept revisiting that weekend was not because something had gone wrong, but the opposite, because of how great the weekend had been. By replaying these happy moments as vividly as she could, albeit under the guise of a search for clues, she was giving herself fixes, small tastes of what she craved so badly, the feeling of being with Rich. This fix-seeking, addict-like behavior is very common when a heart is broken, and we can be quite sophisticated in the justifications we concoct to engage in contact with the person we crave, whether face-to-face, electronically, or in our mind. I once worked with a woman whose ex-boyfriend kept remembering stuff he had left at her apartment that he needed to pick up. He knew she did not have a doorman and would therefore have to meet him in person for each handoff. First, he asked for a t-shirt he had left in her drawer. A few days later, it was gym shorts. My patient drew the line when he asked to retrieve a chipped dessert dish he had forgotten in her kitchen cupboard. Of course, many of us skip justifications altogether and simply indulge these powerful urges, unaware we are doing so in order to get our fix and keep our symptoms of withdrawal at bay. We might send dozens of texts, call to hear their voice on their outgoing message, accidentally include them on group emails, hang out where we hope to run into them, seek out their friends and family, or mistakenly dial them on our phones. But in the era of social media, the most common way people satisfy their craving for the person who broke their heart is to stalk them digitally. Cyberstalking from the comfort of our phones. Dev, a divorced sales manager in his 40s, had initially come to therapy to focus on issues related to his professional career. A few sessions into our work, he casually mentioned that after having a bad fight with his current girlfriend, he stayed up all night, looking through his old college girlfriend's Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat feeds. "No, no, it's cool," he assured me after my eyebrows shot up before I could stop them. "I'm totally over her. It's just something I do when I'm stressed," he said, waving his hand dismissively. "I use accounts with a fake name, so it's totally harmless. She doesn't know it's me." It had been more than 20 years since Dev's college girlfriend broke up with him. He had been in an 11-year marriage and a couple of short-term relationships since then. I asked him when he began cyberstalking his college ex. "I guess when I was married," Dev admitted. "I usually did it after my ex-wife and I argued, you know, to calm down." According to Dev, he would go for months without his college girlfriend even crossing his mind. But every so often, he found himself compelled to obsessively review her social media activity. When I characterized his behavior in those terms, Dev objected. He didn't see himself as compelled, nor did he perceive his behavior as obsessive. "It's just a distraction," he insisted, "like Candy Crush. It's just a silly way to let off steam." "You stayed up all night," I pointed out. "That's a lot of steam." "Did you make it to work the next day?" Deb shook his head. "And here we've been discussing how much your career means to you," I continued. "Can we agree that if you stayed up all night and risked missing work, the urge to do so must have been pretty powerful?" This time Dev nodded. Dev's behavior reminded me of what often happens when people stop using addictive substances. An ex-smoker who had not touched a cigarette in years or even decades might, in response to a stressful situation or trigger, feel a sudden, intense need for a cigarette. Alcoholics and former substance abusers might have similar unexpected moments of powerful cravings, even years into their sobriety. Most former addicts, smokers included, are able to manage such pangs because they are highly aware of how risky it would be to indulge them. One drag of a cigarette can reactivate days of intense cravings for nicotine for an ex-smoker. A single dose of heroin can have a similar effect on an opioid addict. But few of us are aware that indulging the urge to look up the person who broke our hearts years ago can reactivate our addiction to them. we see our actions as being motivated by mere curiosity, and the outcome of our efforts as essentially harmless. We are also likely to ignore the fact that these kinds of cyber searches are almost always responses to psychological stressors, such as setbacks, loneliness, or frustration in our current relationship. That such behaviors are related to addiction responses is the last thing we would consider. The impulse notwithstanding, what makes cyberstalking so common is the current ease with which we can justify these romantic cravings, even if we don't recognize them as such. No matter where we are or what the hour, our phones are always there, ready to teleport us across time and space to become hidden observers of another person's life. Google searches, personal blogs, social media, and other platforms can provide highly personal and even intimate information in the form of text, pictures, videos, and soon full 3D immersion, creating moments of pseudo-connection that can feel almost as real and substantive as having actual contact. Much as drug addicts are urged to erase the contact information of their dealers from their electronic devices, when we find ourselves cyberstalking someone repeatedly, we have to realize we are playing with an old wound, or a fresh one, as cyberstalking is something that happens much more frequently in the early stages of a breakup. If we want to avoid deepening the pain we feel about a fresh loss, or reactivating the wounds of an old one, we have to eliminate our options to do so and go on a blocking and deleting spree. Difficult as it is to unfriend, unfollow, block, or delete our access to the person's cyber world, it is the only prudent way to prevent ourselves from stalking them again in the future. Of course, as any cyber stalker knows, eliminating direct access to our ex is entirely insufficient, as we will then be tempted to spend even more time scanning the social media accounts of their friends and family in hopes of finding news and images of them in their feeds. Therefore, we have to truly erase all access points. It might feel overly harsh, final, and even brutal to burn all our cyber bridges to our ex's life. But if we are serious about ceasing our cyber stalking and easing our emotional attachment to them, we simply must do it. Because cyberstalking usually happens when breakups are fresh, and since Dev's breakup with his college girlfriend happened so many years in the past, I was curious to hear how the relationship had ended. "It was rough," Dev responded. "She was my first everything. She decided to move back to California after graduation and didn't want a long-distance relationship. I tried to convince her to give it a try at least, but no dice. I really loved her. You know how it is. You have no pride. So I totally begged. I begged her to stay. Then I begged her to give the long-distance thing a chance. But her mind was made up. Like I said, no pride, so I kept at it regardless. But the more I begged, the colder she became. I ended up getting really pissed. I told her she would never find anyone as good as me, that she would never be happy in California. She refused to talk to me after that." Dev looked down as he continued. "I didn't want to accept it was over. I took it hard, man. Real hard. I was like a crazy person, screaming and yelling one minute and crying like a baby the next." Dev's experience was dramatic, yet typical. Many of us struggle to accept the reality of a breakup when our heart is broken. Known as the protest phase, we are likely to try anything and everything to win back the affection of the person we love, even when they are exceedingly clear that the relationship is over. Dev tried reasoning and convincing, guilt trips, and even begging, but all to no avail. When we do finally recognize we cannot salvage the relationship, another common reaction is often triggered, abandonment rage, which is characterized by quickly vacillating between utter fury and total devastation. In the days following the breakup, Dev left his ex-girlfriend dozens of phone messages, long angry tirades, then tearful apologies, then another round of furious expletives. Coming to terms with the reality of a breakup is often different from the psychological process we go through when dealing with other forms of grief. We do not necessarily move through a linear progression of the five stages of grief from shock or denial to anger and rage, bargaining, despair, and finally acceptance. Instead, we often vacillate between denial and despair, hope and rage, helplessness and fury. It is these emotional swings that made Dev feel like a crazy person. Indeed, the arc of our emotional pendulum can feel so uncharacteristically wide in such situations, many whose heart is broken actually fear they are going crazy or heading toward a full-fledged mental breakdown. Although heartbreak can cause some people to have a real mental breakdown, the vast majority of us do not decompensate to that extent. While we might have moments in which we act out of our minds and do things we ordinarily would not, those are usually just moments or incidents, after which we regain our reason and mental faculties. Episodes of anxiety and depression are also very common when our heart is broken, as are disturbances in sleep, appetite, or impulsivity. But these too do not usually involve a complete loss of reason or functioning of the kind that might require psychiatric hospitalization. However, the fear that we are losing our minds is indeed problematic, not because we are likely to go crazy, to reiterate, we are not, but because the worry it creates adds a huge amount of stress and distress to our already overburdened coping mechanisms. We are then at risk of developing an array of other psychiatric symptoms that might fall short of a mental breakdown, but are nonetheless extremely unpleasant, damaging, and even scary. Heartbreak stresses the brain, the mind, and the body. As the day of his college girlfriend's departure approached, Dev became more and more concerned about his deteriorating mental health. In his mind, every uncharacteristic incident of rage and sobbing represented him inching another stitch closer to his own proverbial straitjacket. Dev's friends became concerned as well. They had never seen him behave this way before, and more important, none of them had experienced heartbreak of this magnitude before. Therefore, they had no reference point from which to judge whether his behavior was normative. Consequently, they decided to intervene and address Dev's psychological symptoms using a treatment method favored by many heartbroken young adults: tequila. "The night my girlfriend left for California, my friends told me they were taking me out to do shots," Dev explained. "I thought it was a great idea. I took the subway up to my friend Andy's house. I was about to change trains when it started, a kind of tightening in my chest. It came on really quickly. Every breath hurt and I couldn't get enough air. I realized I was having a heart attack." Dev quickly put up his hand to preempt the objection he was sure I was about to make, even though I had not moved a muscle. "Yeah, I know, Doc. I was a healthy 22-year-old. No reason I should be having a heart attack. But it totally felt like one. I thought, this is it. I'm going to die." Dev managed to get to Andy's apartment. When Andy saw Dev on his doorstep, pale, hyperventilating and clutching his chest, he took him straight to the emergency room. He was rushed right inside and given a cardiac workup. The doctor then returned with a diagnosis. Dev was not having a heart attack. He was having a panic attack. Panic attacks cause shallow breathing, tightness in the chest, and an overwhelming sense of doom, which is why so many people who have them end up in the emergency room convinced they're having a heart attack. And while a panic attack is no picnic, having one poses a far less severe threat to our long-term health and longevity than a heart attack does. That said, Dev's fears were not entirely misplaced. Having our heart broken can actually cause heart failure in rare cases. Known as broken heart syndrome, In some individuals, the stress and emotional pain of a breakup can be so severe as to actually cause cardiac abnormalities such as significant chest pain, spasms, and elevated levels of norepinephrine and epinephrine, the fight-or-flight hormones associated with extreme stress, that are at 30 times normal levels. However, despite these commonalities, patients suffering from broken heart syndrome show no evidence of clogged arteries or irreversible heart damage, and they typically recover more quickly than one would from an actual heart attack. Dev was relieved he had not suffered a heart attack, but the incident made him even more convinced he was at risk of going crazy, which only added to his general stress. Heartbreak can make our bodies go into fight-or-flight mode and trigger stress responses that flood our systems with cortisol, the stress hormone. Stress, especially when it's ongoing, impacts our bodies in a variety of damaging ways. Cortisol makes our immune system function less efficiently. As a result, we are less able to ward off illness and disease, and it takes us longer to recover when we do get sick. Indeed, studies have found that heartbreak is associated with suppressed immune system functioning. This is why, when we are under periods of intense stress, we can feel run down and can get a cold or the flu because our immune systems are not doing their jobs very effectively. Further, chronic stress can impact our cardiovascular functions and digestion and put us at greater risk for heart disease, obesity, and type 2 diabetes. Stress also taxes our coping mechanisms, thereby lowering our psychological thresholds, often to the extent that small frustrations, irritations, or disappointments we would usually be able to shrug off pierce our coping mechanisms and elicit greater distress and reactivity. We might open the fridge in the morning, realize we are out of milk and burst into tears, forget our umbrella on a rainy day and feel like screaming in frustration, or get incredibly irritated with a friend or loved one for the smallest infraction. Indeed, over the months it took Dev to get over his breakup, he felt generally run down, lethargic, and was prone to headaches, stomach aches, and upper respiratory illness. When we catch ourselves thinking and behaving in abnormal ways for us, in the throes of a broken heart, and we worry we might be losing it, we need to remind ourselves that our wild and vacillating reactions are not signs of mental breakdown, but responses to terrible emotional pain. Reassuring ourselves that we are not going crazy, and reminding ourselves that our behavior will stabilize once our emotional pain subsides, can help us remove at least one layer of stress, the "am I going nuts" layer, from our already overstressed minds and bodies. Despite how painful and difficult his breakup was, and how worried he had been about losing his mind, Dev truly believed he had gotten over his college girlfriend and moved on. And while in many ways he had, the wounds heartbreak creates are such that even once we've healed, an emotional and psychological vulnerability might still remain. Dev's cyberstalking might have started innocently, but by doing it repeatedly over the years, he had inadvertently reopened his old wounds. To close them, he would first have to accept that some of the feelings he had for his old college girlfriend still lingered decades later. Studies of grieving have found that having catastrophic beliefs about our reactions to heartbreak and what they imply about our character or our mental health are associated with poor or incomplete recoveries. I decided to discuss these research findings with Dev in order to provide him with a framework for understanding why he was still preoccupied with his college girlfriend so many years later. When I suggested he was still dealing with an unresolved grief about his breakup, he bristled. Unresolved grief? About my college girlfriend? I don't have unresolved grief about her, he insisted. I don't have any grief about her. I told you I'm over her. and yet you spend hours stalking her online.
Don't like that word, Dev objected.
Surveilling her, then.
Sounds worse, Dev responded.
How does spying sound?
Fine, Dev capitulated.
Let's say I stalked her online. I still don't feel grief.
Okay, you don't feel grief, I agreed.
But how did you feel seeing images and videos of her?
Dev shrugged. I persisted.
Are you telling me you had no emotional reaction at all? No pinch in the heart? No twist in the gut? No pang of longing?
For the first time, I saw Dev actually take a moment to think back and consider his reaction.
Pinching and twisting, no, but maybe a pang, he finally admitted.
There's an emotional wound there that never fully healed, I said.
I'm not saying it's a huge one, and I'm not saying it can't heal. But stalking her online is keeping it fresh, and that's not the only way it's hurting you, I added.
Dev cocked his head.
What do you mean?
It's not just the stalking that's problematic. It's when you choose to do it, when you feel frustrated or upset at the woman you're with at the time. You're using your college girlfriend as an emotional escape hatch, instead of channeling your efforts into fixing the problem in your current relationship.
Because so many years had passed since Dev's heartbreak, the tenacity of his negative cognitions was weaker than is often the case when our pain is fresh. As we talked further, he was able to recognize the pattern in his behavior. Stalking his college girlfriend was his way of emotionally disengaging from his current girlfriend when conflict arose, an unconscious way of protecting himself from the potential heartbreak to come. When we find ourselves revisiting old relationships in our mind or on our electronic devices, especially ones that ended in heartbreak, we should always consider the context of our current relationship. When we suddenly or coincidentally think of our ex and decide to look him or her up, it is rarely sudden or coincidental. It is usually a reaction to something going on in our present, more specifically in our present relationship. The healthier and more productive response would be to identify what exactly might be irking us at the moment, and to address it with a person with whom we are currently involved, rather than to displace those feelings onto figures from our past. I worked with Dev for several more months, during which he deleted his fake accounts and vowed to avoid stalking his college girlfriend in any manner. We were then able to refocus our work on Dev learning more adaptive ways of resolving conflict in his current relationship. His girlfriend moved in several months later. Heartbreak impacts our minds, our brains, and our bodies in direct, measurable, and unfortunate ways. Sadly, we often respond to these assaults by taking a bad situation and unwittingly making it much worse. As we shall see, to heal from a broken heart, we have to first stop making things worse. Chapter 3. The Many Mistakes That Set Us Back. If there were mental switches we could flip to stop feeling pain and grief when our heart is broken, we would obviously flip them. Alas, such switches do not exist. Unfortunately, what do exist are mental switches that make us feel worse, compound our grief, and prolong our recovery. And although we do so unwittingly, we flip those bad ones all the time. Perhaps the saddest truth about heartbreak is that in the deepest throes of our grief, the very instincts we rely on to guide us often lead us astray, and we are likely to indulge thoughts and behaviors that feel extremely right in the moment, but are in fact quite psychologically damaging. The Importance of Achieving Closure. Kathy, whose boyfriend Rich broke up with her after a romantic weekend in New England, spent countless hours analyzing every nuance of their trip, convinced something must have happened to cause the breakup.
Images from their trip constantly popped into her mind unbidden, and Kathy pursued each one of these uninvited mental guests, hoping they would lead her to the crucial clue. But Kathy's entire exploration was founded on two incorrect assumptions. First, she assumed something vital had indeed happened that weekend, something significant enough to cause Rich to break up with her 2 weeks later. Yet Rich had already explained his reasons for the breakup, and they not only fit the facts of the relationship, they also fit who Rich was as a person. Despite the anguish the breakup caused her, Kathy still considered Rich a nice guy. Indeed, the one characteristic Kathy and her friends commented on most frequently throughout the relationship was how exceptionally nice and decent Rich was. And he was. Over the 6 months he dated Kathy, he repeatedly and consistently demonstrated empathy and compassion. His kindness was even evident in how he broke up with her. Rich explained that he truly liked Kathy and really cared for her. He emphasized that he authentically enjoyed her company, which is why he was able to enjoy a lovely weekend with her so close to the breakup. But after dating Kathy for 6 months, his feelings for her had simply not progressed sufficiently. As much as he liked Kathy, he wasn't in love with her. Since he wanted to give the relationship every chance to succeed, he suggested the romantic weekend in New England to see if it would tip his feelings for Kathy into the love column. Once he realized his feelings hadn't changed, he let Kathy know right away. He was well aware of the physical ordeals she had already endured, and he knew delaying the breakup would only make it more painful for Kathy in the future. In other words, there was no mystery to be solved. Nothing happened on their romantic weekend that soured Rich on the relationship. Rather, not enough happened to change how he felt. Despite both of them having a wonderful time, Rich simply didn't cross an emotional threshold and fall in love. Kathy's second assumption was even more problematic. She believed whatever went wrong that weekend must have been her fault. Feeling responsible for the demise of the relationship, yet not knowing what she had done to cause it, only added fuel to her desperate search for answers. Refusing to accept Rich's perfectly reasonable and logical explanation for the breakup was a huge mistake on Kathy's part, one that significantly impeded her psychological recovery. Studies of romantic breakups have identified a variety of variables that predict healthy emotional adjustment and timely psychological healing. One of the main factors that allows us to let go and move on is having certainty about why the breakup occurred. Having a clear understanding of why things ended helps us reach closure much sooner than we might otherwise. Had Kathy simply accepted Rich's reasons at the time, she could have avoided months of needless mental analysis and intense and prolonged emotional anguish. The dangers of assuming we are to blame. The psychological damage Kathy unwittingly inflicted on herself extended far beyond the mere delay of her recovery. By assuming she was somehow to blame for the demise of the relationship, she was keeping herself stuck in debilitating feelings of loss. When feelings of grief do not ease after 6 months, it can be a sign that we have developed an abnormal response to loss and heartbreak, known as complicated grief. Studies of complicated grief, sometimes called persistent complex bereavement disorder, have illuminated the crucial and damaging role of negative cognitions. Negative cognitions are inaccurate thoughts or beliefs that make us feel bad about ourselves and prevent us from resuming our lives in a productive way. Psychologically speaking, negative cognitions have three features. They are self-critical, harmful, or limiting. They are inaccurate to some degree, and often significantly so, and most problematic, we tend to be convinced they are true. In fact, In many cases, the thought of questioning the veracity or validity of a negative cognition never even crosses our mind. We just think of them as factual. Negative cognitions are by no means unusual, as it is not uncommon to harbor a few, even if in mild forms. Such erroneous beliefs usually exist side by side with feelings of low self-esteem, depression, anxiety, and of course, heartbreak and grief. Many forms of psychotherapy involve identifying and challenging the patient's negative cognitions, as doing so is a proven and highly effective therapeutic technique. There are many forms of negative cognitions. Some tend to be far more damaging than others and put us at risk for developing complicated grief. One of these is excessive self-blame. Kathy believed she had made a critical mistake, one that led to the end of the relationship. She was entirely unaware that this assumption was completely false, and therefore she had no recognition of the extent to which it sabotaged her ability to move through the grieving process, or how it increased her risk of developing both depression and anxiety. Self-blame is equally common and just as damaging when we lose a cherished pet. We might chastise ourselves for not realizing sooner that something was wrong, for leaving the cage or window open, for failing to close the gate to the yard, for not anticipating traffic on a quiet street, for not holding their leash tight enough, for not realizing they had eaten something harmful, for not being there for their final moments, or for not appreciating them enough when they were alive. To be clear, the mere existence of such thoughts does not automatically condemn us to developing complicated grief. The tendency to blame ourselves when our heart is broken is hardly unusual. What matters is how long we allow such feelings to linger. Most of us let go of guilt and regret naturally as we move through the grieving process. A second negative cognition that has been associated with complicated grief is having extremely negative beliefs about our self. Lauren, the socially anxious medical student, cried for days after being turned down for a second date. In her eyes, the rejection only reinforced her long-standing insecurities about her appearance. While most of us are likely to focus on our shortcomings in the aftermath of a rejection, doing so excessively and catastrophically is problematic. Thoughts such as, "I wish I were prettier," or "I don't like my smile," are unfortunate, but not unusual. But Lauren verbalized beliefs like, "No man will ever want me," and "I'll be alone forever." Since Lauren's maladaptive cognitions occurred in the immediate aftermath of her rejection, she by no means qualified for the diagnosis of complicated grief. But unless she began to question her harsh and punitive self-perceptions, she would certainly be at risk for developing other psychological disorders. As with all negative self-cognitions, Lauren's by no means reflected an objective reality. She had her profile up on the dating site for less than a week when she scored her first date, and by her own admission, she had already been contacted by a dozen men in that time. When I pointed this out to her, she recoiled and asserted she would never date any of them. However, my point wasn't that Lauren should date those men, or that any of them were a good match for her, but that their interest was clear evidence men found her attractive. After all, there were a dozen of them in a single week. Lauren admitted that her friend had also tried to make the same point, but as is often the case with negative self-cognitions, especially ones we have been cultivating for years, Lauren struggled to let go of her self-critical beliefs and dismissed any evidence that contradicted them. A rule of thumb we should try to live by is that if two different people, other than our parents or grandparents who are typically the least objective members of our support systems, make the same point, for example, that people find us attractive, or that our ex's rationale for breaking up is reasonable, and it is one we truly bristle at, we should absolutely pause and give it strong consideration. First, because two separate people are saying the same thing. and second, because our bristling is indicative that our resistance is being fueled by an underlying issue. For example, we have low self-esteem, or we want to keep getting our fix by searching for a different rationale, and not by the inherent incorrectness of the assertion. Why we idealize the person who broke our heart, and why we shouldn't. Some years ago, I had a first session with a young man who came to therapy to work on his dating life. He began describing a party he had recently attended, and happened to mention there were lots of drugs at the party, which he considered a good thing as he was fond of cocaine. Given the casual nature of his admission, I responded in an equally casual manner. How fond? Pretty fond, he responded with a wink and a mischievous smile. But then, a couple of months ago, I found out the cartilage in my left nostril was so damaged from sniffing it, I had to have surgery to replace it with cartilage for my ear. How did that impact your use of cocaine? I asked innocently.
Duh, I use my right nostril.
Unaware of the rudeness of his response, he went on to tell me how great cocaine made him feel, and laid out his arguments for using it, none of which acknowledged the scars in his nose or ear, or the fact that he would soon run out of healthy nostrils. People often justify their use of substances by focusing almost exclusively on how good they feel when they're using, how much fun they have, and how enjoyable the experience is. Their cravings for the drug create an idealized perception that ignores the many terrible mornings and days that follow heavy usage, how much time and money they spend on the drug, and the problems it creates in their lives and relationships. The similarities between addiction and heartbreak are such that our perceptions of the person who broke our heart can become distorted in similar ways. Our cravings for them make us focus disproportionately on their best qualities. We replay the greatest hits of wonderful moments we shared, or imagine those we would have shared in the future. We envision their smile, their laugh, and the times they made us feel attractive, happy, and content. What we focus on much less are their flaws, their annoying habits, the arguments, the tensions, the interests and friendships we gave up to be with them, the times they made us feel terrible about ourselves, the times we cried and were miserable, and the moments we hated their guts and couldn't stand the sight of them. Natural as it is to do so, by idealizing the person who broke our heart and recalling only highly polished versions of our lives with them, we are actually inflating the magnitude of our loss in our own eyes, exacerbating our emotional pain and delaying our recovery. Idealizing in this way can easily become a vicious cycle that intensifies our cravings, which in turn reinforces our idealized perceptions, which intensifies our cravings, and so on. Recently, Ghazi, a man in his late 30s, came into his session bereft and announced his girlfriend of 9 years had left him. He sat there, weeping, barely able to speak.
"I thought she would be my wife, the mother of my children, the woman I grow old with."
Ghazi's emotional pain was very real. What he was saying, not so much. In fact, his girlfriend left him precisely because, despite being with her for 9 years, he had not felt ready to get married. Further, he had broken up with her at least a dozen times over that period, most recently only a couple of months before she left him. At the time, I had suggested to Ghazi the pattern of breakups might suggest he had a problem with commitment. He vehemently disagreed.
"How is it a commitment problem? I keep getting back together with her."
"Exactly," I responded. "You can't commit to the breakups either." The reality was that, commitment issues aside, while he cared for his girlfriend, the relationship just didn't work for him. But in his grief, Ghazi pushed aside 9 years of hesitation and ambivalence and focused only on the good memories. By doing so, he idealized her as well as the relationship, and that distorted perception then led him to perceive himself as losing someone he was going to marry, when 9 years and multiple breakups argued otherwise. The best way to avoid idealizing the person who broke our heart is to deliberately force a balanced perspective in our mind. We have to remind ourselves of the pet peeves they activated. For example, their embarrassing eating habits, their chronic lateness, or the bitten fingernail remnants they expectorated onto the coffee table, their different taste in books, sports, or entertainment, your close friends they never got along with, or their defensiveness whenever you tried to have a discussion about a relationship issue. The idea is not to hate them or vilify them, but to be able to see their flaws and those of the relationship, and not focus exclusively on the good stuff. We often have to remind ourselves of these flaws repeatedly, and we should, as doing so will help us let go and ease our worries about never finding someone as perfect again. How avoidance supersizes grief. When our heart is broken, our efforts to manage the emotional pain we feel can lead us to make decisions that spare us pain in the short term, but increase it in the long run. One of the most common ways we seek to limit our emotional distress is to withdraw from people and activities that remind us of what we have lost. However, the longer the relationship lasted, the list of people or situations that remind us of our loss can be rather significant, and some of them can be meaningful and important aspects of our lives. Avoiding such people, places, or activities can therefore have a huge impact and throw our entire lives out of whack. Lindsay, an amateur triathlete and homemaker from New Jersey, used to wake every morning at 5:30, go down to her basement, place her cat, Mittens, on the shelf facing her stationary bike, and work out for 45 minutes. Some people like watching TV on the stationary bike, she said to me in our session. I like watching Mittens, and she watches me back. It's our quality time together. When Mittens died, Lindsay couldn't stand the thought of doing her morning bike routine without her beloved cat there to watch her and keep her company. She acknowledged she would not be able to compete at the same level if she only biked outdoors, as she was able to do so much less regularly. She also recognized how important competing in triathlons and the fitness her preparation gave her was for her overall physical and mental health. But despite knowing this, she simply could not bring herself to get back on the stationary bike. What Lindsay did not realize was that by cutting off her indoor bike training and thus limiting her ability to compete, she was at risk of losing far more than just her fitness. Being a triathlete had become an important aspect of Lindsay's self-definition, and her fellow competitors represented a significant portion of her social circle. By giving up such meaningful aspects of her life, she was not only compounding her grief about Mittens, she was seriously jeopardizing her mental health. Although it might seem necessary or prudent to avoid that which evokes painful associations of our loss, doing so is rarely wise. A general rule of human psychology is that avoiding things does not lessen their emotional impact on us. It supersizes it. By avoiding her basement, Lindsay wasn't lessening the association between her stationary bike and Mittens. She was making it stronger. I worried that if she continued to avoid her bike, the association with Mittens might spread and contaminate other aspects of her triathlon training. Indeed, this kind of post-heartbreak avoidance often starts small and then spreads, forcing us to continually narrow our spheres of operation as a result, sometimes in impractical and even ludicrous ways. For example, Kathy refused to go to any restaurant she had been to with Rich, as doing so would be too painful a reminder of the breakup. But given how frequently they dined out during their 6-month relationship, Kathy's list of prohibited establishments covered a huge swath of Manhattan real estate. She should have been finding ways to diminish Rich's presence in her daily thoughts. Instead, her avoidance was making it virtually impossible to escape his shadow. When places and people become too tightly associated with our broken heart, We need to cleanse our associations and reclaim them. The best way to do so is by revisiting these places under different and specific circumstances, so we can create new associations for them. For example, I suggested to Kathy that she reclaim the brunch place she used to go to with Rich by turning it into the brunch place.